Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the annual Phoenix Academy Scholarship Luncheon. The featured speaker giving the keynote address will be Aaron Gruelle, founder of the Freedom Writers Foundation and author of Teach With Your Heart. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, October 1st, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Phoenix Academy, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. In addition to Ms. Gruelle's remarks, today's program will present an overview of Phoenix Academy, as well as testimonials from parents, teachers, and students. Here now to introduce the program is Nancy Lieberman, Executive Director of Phoenix Academy.
Phoenix Academy is a full-day intervention school for children in grades kindergarten through eighth grade. We have an intensive curriculum that we believe gives students the jumpstart they need to be successful in school and in life. Success in school is not always an indicator of success in life, but giving a child with the academic or personal struggles the skills, confidence, it gives them hope. Instilling this message becomes harder the longer students continue to fail, as Aaron Gruelle will address today. That is why we believe it is so important to start these interventions in grade school. The statistics are dire for those who do not graduate from high school or who graduate being illiterate. For some students, even with support, school and life may not be easy, and they may need to work twice as hard as anyone else just to achieve their goals and dreams. As you will see and hear today, giving these children the skills, the ability to read, gives them a sense of hope that truly makes a difference. Each year, we meet more and more people who tell us how Phoenix Academy has impacted their lives. I'm delighted to introduce three alumni to you today. Michelle Hagen will be 26 years old later this month, but she still vividly remembers how she felt in fourth grade when they would have the spelling bee games. Her friends would try to whisper the answers to her, or she'd line up to be the first one out so that she wouldn't have to be embarrassed. Reading aloud was also a torture. She went to Phoenix Academy. After that, she went to St. Wenceslaus and on to Marion High School and graduated from UNO. Today, Michelle and her husband, Jake, are expecting their first child, a baby boy, in January. Michelle says, as a parent-to-be, she is so grateful for the sacrifices her parents made to send her to Phoenix Academy, and she hopes to get her little guy started in our summer school program. One more additional note, Michelle's mother, Joanne Meyer, and their dog, Barney, volunteer weekly in the Tiffany Robbins Read to the Dog Therapy Room at Phoenix Academy. My second alum is 22-year-old Rebecca Monier. In fourth grade, Rebecca was struggling with reading, although receiving special help. After trying tutoring, her parents enrolled Becca at Phoenix Academy. This past May, she graduated from Concordia University with a 3.75 grade point average. Becca has a love of adventure and a strong desire to help those in need. Throughout high school and college, she traveled to Africa, Costa Rica, and China on mission trips. In June, she was accepted into the U.S. Peace Corps, and she left for Liberia for 27 months. Unfortunately, that service was cut short and that of the other Peace Corps workers due to the Ebola outbreak. They were sent back home. While she awaits reassignment, we are fortunate to have her, so you can meet her today. Jeremiah Woods is currently a senior at Omaha Northwest High School. Jeremiah's plans after graduation are to go to a four-year college and major in business. He has a passion for cooking and hopes to open his own chain of restaurants someday. Jeremiah has sickle cell anemia, and for the first 10 years of his life, he was quite ill. He missed 3 months of school at a time due to hospitalizations related to his illnesses. His mother, who was raising him on her own, died unexpectedly from complications of surgery when he was only 10. Jeremiah went to live with his Uncle Tony and Aunt Janie. His illness and mother's death were hardships that would allow anyone to want to give this kid some breaks. But as Aunt Janie said, those can't be excuses for not trying your best. Jeremiah attended our summer program and 2 years in our day school. His attendance and effort were fantastic. You'll hear more about him on our video. Could I please have Michelle, Rebecca, and Jeremiah and the families who supported them please stand. Join me in giving them a round of applause. Now we have a short video that tells a little bit more about the Phoenix Academy.
We decided to send Grant to Phoenix Academy about 4 months ago because he was struggling and falling farther and farther behind in school. Within 2 weeks of Grant being enrolled in this school, he started coming home with a positive attitude. His handwriting turned out to be that he could actually write decent. We noticed that immediately. He was taking pride in his work, and he was starting to make friends at school, which he wasn't able to do prior because his self-esteem was shot.
They gave me different tools, not just a one-way method. They gave me different ways of doing it so that way I could go about and really succeed and try to figure out things on my own.
We put him in the summer program, and the summer program went so well, and the repetition that they did was what really made us go back. And then Jeremiah himself said, "I feel so comfortable because I'm not the only child that look like they don't know what's going on."
The philosophy of Phoenix Academy is all students can learn, and no matter their abilities, we strive to make them successful in school. Our curriculum is intensive, it's research-based and multi-sensory so that we can meet the needs of all the different ability levels of all our students.
At the time, our son Joshua was having all sorts of trouble reading. As time went on, he grew more and more frustrated, and it became such a struggle, and he was getting to the point where he would just say, "I'm dumb, I'm never going to learn how to read," you know. And now he loves school. It's just amazing. He's not the same kid.
Nyla's biggest problem was in reading. She could not read. If she can't read, then she can't go far in school. So I searched for another way for her to get a better education, and Phoenix Academy was it. Nyla has more confidence in herself. She's a better reader. She understands what she reads, and she enjoys coming to school, and she has friends.
Phoenix Academy is different from other schools. When children come to our school, we do some individual testing, and based on the results of that testing, they are put in specific groups, and as they progress through the curriculum, they move at their own pace, so the child leads themselves through the curriculum versus the curriculum leading the child.
I believe the Phoenix Academy has prepared Jasmine in incredible ways.
We feel that she's been given the tools that she needs to go forward into high school and eventually into the workforce, and we credit the Phoenix Academy with the success that she's had.
My daughter Sage, before she came to Phoenix Academy, she struggled a lot, and so we went to the summer school that summer, and she made huge leaps just in that short amount of time. And so we enrolled her for the fall, and probably within 2 months, we saw a huge difference. She went from not wanting to go to school ever, every morning was a battle, she'd cry, and then after 2 months, she was organized, she wanted to go to school, she wanted to do her homework every night. I didn't even have to make her sit down to do her homework. And she was happy. I mean, she progressed amazingly.
Sound. Word.
The curriculum at Phoenix Academy is intensive instruction, which incorporates all core content areas of math, reading, and writing. Specifically, our language arts program is the Spalding Method. And as the kids go through the Spalding Method, they focus on seeing, saying, and doing.
Phoenix Academy has helped me with spelling because at my old school, that was what was mostly difficult for me. I didn't know what the words say, and my teacher would have to read them to me, and I just memorized them by looking at it. And Phoenix Academy tells me why it's a Y instead of an E, and it tells me how to spell it, and it makes learning easier for me.
At my old school, I didn't know what letters it would be in words, and by the phonograms here, they have helped me knowing what letters to put in words.
Phoenix Academy helped me math by I didn't know all my multiplication problems. Now I know all of them.
The teachers at Phoenix Academy seem to take kind of a personal investment in what they're doing here. They take pride in the children. They teach them in a way that no other school around does. It seems to really click with the children.
Have felt that they really love our daughter, and we'll go to extra lengths. We feel like when we meet with them to have conferences, it's very honest, very straightforward, and they tell us what she needs and what we can be doing to help her at home. And so we've really appreciated that honesty, that transparency, the professionalism, and the compassion that they have for Jasmine.
Phoenix Academy also helps with financial obligations as well, because we weren't at a place to be able to afford the tuition, and having that extra help was wonderful for us.
If there's any parents out there who are considering sending their children to Phoenix Academy, please look into it. This is for your children's future, for their whole life, and at least in my case, it's changed not only my son's life, but my family life at home.
I didn't really want to leave, but I felt like I was prepared, though.
And this year, he made the honor roll for 3 quarters. And I mean, it feels so good to know that he can make it and that he will be able to make it on his own.
Now I'd like to introduce you to 5 Phoenix Academy scholarship recipients who are at our school right now. Please hold your applause. I'm going to introduce them until I introduce all 5. First, we have Yakin Lorenzo. He is an 8th grader. He started with us in the summer school in 2013, and that was thanks to an OPS teacher who saw what appeared to be laziness was actually a lack of skills. He is making great progress, and you can ask anyone. He has the best handwriting of anybody in the whole school. Isabel Valadez is in her 3rd year at Phoenix Academy. She is our homework queen. She has never received a yellow slip. These are the slips that go home when kids don't do their homework. Isabel is in the 7th grade. Anthony Holler is a 6th grader. He moved here last November from Louisiana, and he lives with his older sister. Anthony has grown not only in his confidence, but he has increased 2 grade levels in reading. Gianna Jerkovac is also a 6th grader. Gianna was born in China, and she was adopted and moved here in 2010. Although she can speak Chinese, Cantonese, Mandarin, and sign language, she needed our phonics-based approach to help her with reading and spelling English. She is making wonderful progress and continues to excel in math, being the top student in algebra. Sage is in 2nd grade, and she used to be very anxious about school. You're not anxious anymore. Are you nervous here? No. Her mom says that she has the hardest time telling Sage to put away her books at night and go to bed because she says, "Can I read just one more chapter?" Her mom says that Phoenix Academy has changed her life. We do believe Phoenix Academy changes lives. It gives students like our alumni, Michelle, Rebecca, and Jeremiah, and our current students, the chance to be successful. It is a very difficult decision to pull a child out of their neighborhood or parish school to attend the Phoenix Academy. However, our phonics-based curriculum, our small class sizes, and direct instruction model help students attend for 6 months to a few years and then return to their previous schools. We believe it changes lives not only for the children, but for the families as well. I would now like to recognize the people here today who have made that difficult decision. would I have all current and former Phoenix Academy students, as well as if you are a parent, grandparent, aunt, uncle, cousin of a child who attended Phoenix Academy, would you please stand and be recognized? Thank you. I'd like to have Michelle Hagen and Rebecca Monier introduce our featured speaker.
Thank you, Nancy. Today's keynote speaker is Erin Gruwell, a teacher, an education activist, and the founder of the Freedom Writers Foundation. She created the Freedom Writers Method, a progressive teaching philosophy and curricula designed to achieve excellence from all students by fostering an educational philosophy that values and promotes diversity. Ms. Gruwell transformed her students' lives. She encouraged them to rethink rigid beliefs about themselves and others, reconsider daily decisions, and ultimately rechart their futures.
With Ms. Gruwell's support, they chose to forego teenage pregnancy, drugs, and violence to become aspiring college students, published writers, and advocates for change. They dubbed themselves the Freedom Writers in homage to the civil rights activists, the Freedom Writers, and published a book. And now, please welcome to the stage Erin Gruwell.
My father, a self-proclaimed civil rights advocate, named his daughter Erin in honor of Hank Aaron, his favorite baseball player. And as a little girl, when I would come home and boys would tease me because they were calling me names or that Erin was a boy's name, I'll never forget my father rolling up his sleeves and saying, "Sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you." And I believed my father, and I believed in justice. And I believed in educating everyone. So when I became a teacher and I heard words like dumb and stupid and nothing uttered about my students, the kids who sat in front of me every single day, I began to disagree with my father because words do hurt. And even though they might not leave visible scars, those scars that sat before me needed to be healed, needed to be whole. You see, I became an English teacher, believing that those words would leap out of the pages of a book, that those characters would speak to my students, that my students who grew up in a dangerous community would put down their fist, put down their gun, pick up a pen, and right a wrong. I believed that Shakespeare would give them a voyage. I believed that Homer would teach them about an odyssey. And when I walked into my classroom and I looked at all of my students, I realized that all 150 of my students at the age of 14 in ninth grade had never read a book from cover to cover. Never. Unlike me, they didn't sit on their daddy's lap and read about green eggs and ham. They never identified Waldo. They didn't have libraries in their homes or take trips to the library. They didn't have trips to Barnes & Noble. Students just didn't read. So I looked at it into this sea of students, 150 strong, and I realized that my students were miserable, and their sole purpose was to make me as miserable as they were, and they did a really good job. When I passed out my syllabus on that very first day, and it had that iambic pentameter by Shakespeare, and it had that tale about an odyssey by Homer, that syllabus came right back at me in the form of a paper airplane with a comment by a student that said, "Why do we have to read books written by dead white guys in tights?" Which is a very profound question. A very profound question to an African-American young boy who grew up in a home where his daddy died of AIDS, a disease that no one seemed to describe to a little boy before his first day in kindergarten. A little boy who never had the luxury of reading about those stories. And in his mind, Shakespeare was not going to leap out of the pages of a book and help his hardworking mom. Because no matter how hard she worked, No matter how hard she tried, she was never going to get that fancy house on the hill, that 15 minutes. Instead, what he would see is a mother who'd come home demoralized and tired with those calluses and those blisters. And he'd have to shoo away those cockroaches and those rats. So books written by somebody on a map he couldn't even identify weren't going to help him survive, weren't going to help him get from point A to point B. Another student walked into my classroom on that very first day, and instead of bringing me a shiny red apple and ready to dive into those lessons, she walked in with a black eye. She walked in with an ankle monitor. She walked in with a probation officer. She, too, had never sat in her daddy's lap. How could she? Her father was currently serving a life sentence in a maximum security prison. So in her mind, she was going to follow in the footsteps of her father, be behind bars. She didn't aspire to go to places like Yale. She assumed she was going to go to jail. And in fact, she already had. As a young girl at the age of 14, she'd already been to boot camp and a juvenile hall. She didn't believe that words could liberate. She didn't believe that she could pick up a pen and right a wrong. She was going to be just like her daddy. I tell you that because I looked at its sea of students. I realized that each and every one of them had a story. And I so desperately wanted them to put down that fist, pick up that book, find themselves somewhere within the pages. So I went to see my principal at the end of that first day after I picked up all the syllabi from the floor, after I scrubbed the graffiti off their desk, after I learned words I had never heard before. And I went to my principal. I want to know, who are these students? Why are they so miserable? And unfortunately, my principal was jaded. And he had the rap sheets to prove it. And he started rattling off statistics that in this very large urban school district, that I had the 150 kids that nobody really wanted. Kids who came from boot camp or juvenile hall, like a Darius, like a Maria. Kids who bounced around from group home to shelter to foster home. Kids who had been in rehab for crystal meth or crack cocaine. And tragically, most of these young kids had a single mom who didn't have the time during the day to pick up that phone or come to a back-to-school night meeting or to join the PTA. And every single one of my 150 students had scored below the 25th percentile on every standardized test. So my principal, rather than being a sage or a mentor, on that very first day told me that these students were going to drop out before we took our standardized test. And he hoped they would, so they wouldn't pull the entire school score down. And I thought about that horrifying statistic. Where were these kids going to go? Do we really want kids to be invisible? Do we really want kids to go back to the margins? Do we really want kids who have never read to have that be their lot in life, to be in those jail cells, to be on the street, to hear those words like dumb and stupid and nothing? I remember fumbling for my keys and making that drive home and thinking, do I call my father, this civil rights activist, and talk about how education, which should be the greatest equalizer of an unfair playing field, isn't so fair? Do I go back to the halls of academia and engage my fancy professor with her PhD, that fancy professor with blue hair who has not been in a contemporary classroom since Leave It to Beaver? Or do I treat my 14-year-old students like they have a PhD themselves? Do I allow them to use their voice? Do I allow them to be seen? So I tried a little experiment. I looked at Maria in that back corner, throwing up her gang signs, carving her initials on a desk, and I thought, maybe, just maybe, maybe I can get her to pick up a pen and tell me her story about night after night when she crossed her fingers and wondered and wished, if I'm good this time, will Daddy come home at Christmas? Will Daddy bring me a present and tell me he loves me? And yet he never shows up. Will this little girl pick up a pen and tell me about the hours upon hours that her mom struggles to put a roof over their head, to put a little food on that table? How her mom would get up at the crack of dawn and go and clean beautiful homes that my student at the age of 14 realized we're never going to live in, we're never going to afford. And then she'd watch her mom go off to beautiful hotels and she'd scrub toilets. Beautiful hotels that my 14-year-old student realized we're never going to stay in, we're never going to afford. And tragically, on most nights, her mom would go off to a sweatshop and sew beautiful dresses that my student realized my mom was never going to wear. I wanted Maria to tell me that story, to tell me her story, to think about a different vision, a different destiny. So I went out and got these marble journals, and I told my students for the first time I didn't care about spelling or grammar or punctuation. I just wanted my students to write what needed to be written, to tell an ordinary teacher their extraordinary tale. So I waited, and I watched her kind of scribble in that journal, and I thought she was going to write some kind of manifesto. It was a manifesto. It was not what I was prepared to read. She wrote, "I hate Erin Gruwell, and if I wasn't on probation, I would probably shank her." Exclamation point. So at least she got the grammar right. And as a young woman who grew up in suburbia, I didn't even know what shanking was at that point, but I will tell you now, it is not good. So I realized there's a reason that she's not looking at this page and this pen as something that will liberate her. So how can I allow my students to have a voice, to trust words, to trust academia, to trust me? Because all they saw was some crazy woman wearing polka dots and pearls with perceived white privilege. And they looked at me and they thought, there's no way that this crazy woman understands what goes on in our heads. She hasn't heard those voices of all of those people who tell them they don't belong. Those F's, those D's, that laughter. I just wanted Maria to tell me her story. And when she finally did, it was horrifying. She took us back to a moment when she was 5 years old. 5 years old with pigtails and crayons, as cute as a button. Like our little sage up here with a smile from ear to ear. And even though she was poor, and even though Daddy was rotting in a cell, she was a good little girl. And even though her daddy had made some bad decisions, she believed that her daddy was not a bad person. So her daddy told her, be the American dream. He wanted her to go off to school and learn ABCs and 1-2-3s and be that American dream like so many parents want for their students. So at 5 years old, with those pigtails and those crayons and those hopes and those dreams, this little girl stood at a bus stop, waiting to be whisked off by that bus to go off like every kid and have that opportunity to learn. When she walked into that classroom on that very first day, she looked around and she realized, I'm different. I'm poor. I can't afford those fancy designer jeans like everyone else is wearing. And when I raise my hand at the age of 5, what comes out is this combination of English and Spanish, the Spanglish, and people laughed at her. And she told me that the person who laughed the loudest and the longest on that very first day was her teacher. Because what came out of her mouth was this combination, this Spanglish that they spoke at home. So on that very first day, her first lesson in education was that it's easier to make people laugh with you than at you. It's easier to be a bully. It's easier to be in on that joke. It's easier to make people laugh with you. So at the age of 5 in kindergarten, Maria Reyes gave up on that teacher. She gave up on that classroom. And she gave up on education. And her father, who came home from jail, was going to become her teacher. And he was going to teach his daughter lessons from the streets. And those lessons didn't come from a book or a box of crayons. Instead, this father gave his daughter at the age of 5 shiny red boxing gloves, and he told her in no uncertain terms, life is tough, and when it knocks you down, you better get back up swinging. So at the age of 5, this little girl learned how to swing first and to swing fast, how to keep a stiff upper lip, never cry, because if she did, she may never stop. And the most important lesson her daddy taught her was, don't you rat or snitch on a homeboy. So when the Los Angeles Police Department stormed into that tiny one-bedroom apartment, handcuffed her daddy again, and this time took him off to a maximum security prison, San Quentin, Maria had to teach herself those lessons. And she went through life swinging hard and swinging fast. So by the time she was 14 years old, a freshman in high school, she and 149 other students believed the rhetoric, believed they were supposed to drop out by their freshman year. Maria believed that she was going to be pregnant by the time she was 15, like her mother. believe that she was going to be behind bars like her father by the age of 16. And tragically, believe that she was going to be 6 feet under by the time she turned 18, just like her friends, just like her cousins, just like her community. When I listened to Maria tell her story, I realized that each and every kid has a story. And even though in the halls of academia we are taught to teach to a test, Maria became my teacher because standing before her, I was so humbled. Because at that moment, I realized there is no one-size-fits-all for every kid. And she was begging, screaming to the rafters, "Teach to me. I am more than those numbers, more than those statistics, more than data." So I decided to give my students the opportunity to have a voice, to tell their story, to say so much, even if they didn't have the right words. So I decided to play a game that was anything but. And I simply put this piece of tape down the center of my floor. And I hoped that that piece of tape would be this gravitational pull to pull those kids out of the darkness and for the first time to be seen. Because seeing them meant I would see their story. And I realized I had to be sneaky and subversive because I was competing against pop culture. The hour upon hour kids played video games that are live and in 3D with images jumping off a screen. Or the hour upon hour kids sit in front of a television watching mindless television, reality shows. Or when those kids sneak into those darkened movie theaters and for 2 hours escape the reality watching Marvel characters leap off the page. So I decided that I had to ask my students what they knew. This song, this show, this character in a movie, this icon. So I began with questions I knew my students knew, the latest album, the hot movie. And as I asked each and every question, my kids would come to line. They would giggle, they would fist bump, and they'd roll their eyes and think, "This crazy woman has no idea what she's doing." But they kept coming. They came for that song about Snoop. They came for that movie. And then the questions got real. Stand in the line if you know someone who is poor. And every single one of my kids stood on that line because that someone was them. And at the age of 14, each and every one of my kids knew in the pit of their stomach what it felt to be hungry, what it felt to wish that Christmas and birthdays would just go away. Because when you ask that hardworking mom for that top video game or those designer jeans, you realize, what is mama going to have to go without? What are we going to have to sacrifice this month? Is it lights? Is it food? Is it gas? So each and every one of my students stood in that line, regardless of their shape, their size, their color, their hue, the God that they pray to. And I realized this is going to change the game. Because each and every time I ask my students to stand in line, they're telling a story. They came to that line when I asked stories about stand in line if you've ever been homeless. And they stood there. They looked at their feet, hoping the floor would swallow them whole. They were nervous because this is my story now, but this story doesn't define me. I might not have a roof over my head. I might not have a place to sleep. I don't even know where my next meal's coming from. But things are going to change. My students were tired of being poor. My students were tired of being picked on. They were tired of not knowing how to say the words the correct way. They were tired of red markers bleeding on their page. They stood on that line because they had learning disabilities. They stood on that line because they were bullied and then became the bullier. They stood on that line because they had received those F's and those D's, because they had been called dumb and stupid. And each and every time my kids stood on that line, I realized that my classroom had to become a place that allowed these students to have a second chance, a do-over. How could we wipe that slate clean? How could we start anew? So I decided that we were going to have a toast for change. Because in my life, we were always raising a glass and we were always celebrating. When I turned 16, I got the keys to a car and a driver's license. And we raised a glass. When I was 18, I was headed off to the dorms at the university and we raised that glass. And throughout my life, we were raising a glass if someone got engaged or graduated, got that job promotion, that first home. But I realized for my students, they weren't raising those glasses to celebrate. Instead, they were licking those wounds. Instead, they were standing in assembly lines at funeral parlors. Instead, they were intersecting those report cards and throwing them away before mom and dad saw them. So I wanted my students for the first time to pick up a plastic champagne glass and to make a toast. Maybe it doesn't matter that you have a 0.5 GPA. Maybe it doesn't matter that you've never read a book from cover to cover. Maybe it doesn't matter that you confuse those letters. Maybe it doesn't matter that you've never been tested for that learning disability like dyslexia. Starting today, starting right now, we're going to start over. So I stole a cue from a friend of mine who was a kindergarten teacher, because as we all know, kindergarten teachers are just much more fun. And I have convinced myself that when kindergarten teachers walk, flowers magically sprout at their feet. They have better handwriting. Their bulletin board is much more sexy than my bulletin board was ever going to be. So I thought, we're going to take it back, old school, back in the day when they had show and tell. Because at 14 years old, I looked around and I realized my students missed out on that. Maybe they didn't have anything to show. Maybe those proud mamas told them, don't you dare tell. So we were going to have a do-over. We were going to have show and tell. So I made some silly signs. I blew up some balloons. I went out and got plastic champagne glasses, filled them with sparkling apple cider. I wanted my kids to come in and pick up that plastic champagne glass and start over. And there was a part of me, a small part of me, that wanted to prove to those cynical teachers in the teacher's lounge who had told me that my students would never read a book from cover to cover that they were wrong. I wanted to prove to those teachers who believed in those test scores and those data and statistics, because I wanted my students to pick up that number two pencil and bubble in all the right answers for the first time. I wanted my kids to pick up a book and to find themselves within the pages without getting the cliff notes, without renting the movie, without going on the internet and downloading somebody else's paper. I wanted my students to complete a book, to pick up that pen, and to write that perfect five-paragraph essay. Because up until that moment, I had been brainwashed like so many teachers in our country to teach to that test. But when my students walked in and saw those plastic champagne glasses and this celebration, a celebration of their spirit, a celebration of their potential and their promise, it wasn't just simply about a number two pencil or a book or a five-paragraph essay. So my students picked up that plastic champagne glass and they got very serious. And they dared to dream. They dared to dream about what would it be like for the first time to find out about a character, to have those words leap off a page, to transfix and to transform, to travel, to go to places in my mind, to see things that I've never seen before, not in a television show or on a movie screen, but with my mind. To raise my hand and not have people laugh at me because I don't know how to pronounce the words the right way. And as each and every one of my students dared to dream, there was a moment. There was a moment that someone raised his hand and he wanted to share something. He wanted to read what he had written in his marble journal. And thank God it didn't say, I want to shank my teacher. He wrote a story. He wrote a story about a moment that he stood in line at the age of 14 and declared to everybody by saying so much, by not saying anything at all, that I live in a homeless shelter, that my hardworking mom can't afford those fancy designer jeans and those video games, that all I want to do is fit in. All I want to do is play hoops with the boys and have an identity. I'm tired of people laughing at me. I'm tired of being different. I want to break a cycle. I want things to be better. So for a brief moment, I'm going to take you into my classroom, and I'm going to give you a small glimpse of what that toast for change was like. And the young boy who's going to read this journal, this young boy, ironically, had a learning disability. Wasn't diagnosed until he was 14 years old and in my class. But the story he told was so eloquent, so rich with metaphors and analogies, that I wanted him to understand that he had something to say. I didn't know it would be immortal. I didn't know that it would leave a legacy. I didn't know that we would be able to find a young boy on the streets of Los Angeles who was also homeless, who also had a learning disability, who would pick up my son's journal. I call him my son because he's really my student. Pick up my son's journal and read it, because that was his story. So for a brief moment, I want to take you back into my classroom, into room 203, when for the first time my students realized that school is not just about bells and whistles. It's about finding our purpose, finding our voice, and about leaving a legacy. So if you turn your attention to the screen, I'd like to introduce you to my sons, to my daughters, to the Freedom Riders.
Okay, guys, gals, listen up. This is what I want you to do. I want each of you to step forward and take one of these Borders bags, which contain the four books we're going to read this semester.
All right.
They're very special books, and they each remind me in some way of each of you. But before you take the books, I want you to take one of these glasses of sparkling cider, and I want each of you to make a toast. We're each gonna make a toast for change. And what that means is, from this moment on, every voice that told you you can't is silenced. Every reason that tells you things will never change disappears. And the person you were before this moment, that person's turn is over. Now it's your turn. Okay? Okay. You ready to get this party going on?
Come on.
What? What's the deal?
Man, I've had a boyfriend since I was like 11, you know?
I believe.
Okay, well, I was always the person that was gonna get pregnant before I turned 16 and drop out. Like my mom. Ain't gonna happen.
Nobody ever listens to a teenager. No, everybody thinks you should be happy just because you're young. They don't see the wars that we fight every single day. And one day my war will end. And I will not die. And I will not tolerate abuse from anyone. I am strong.
My mom's kicked me out when I got jumped into the gang life. But I like her to see me graduate. I like to be 18.
Ms. G, can I read something from my diary?
That'd be great. Who is he?
Man, he's been with us since freshman year, fool.
What's his name?
I don't know.
The summer was the worst summer in my short 14 years of life. It all started with a phone call. My mother was crying and begging, asking for more time. As if she were gasping for her last breath of air. She held me as tight as she could and cried. Her tears hit my shirt like bullets and told me we were being evicted. She kept apologizing to me. I thought I have no home. I should have asked for something less expensive at Christmas. On the morning of the eviction, a hard knock on the door woke me up. The sheriff was there to do his job. I looked up at the sky, waiting for something to happen. My mother has no family to lean on, no money coming in. Why bother coming to school or getting good grades if I'm homeless? The bus stops in front of the school. I feel like throwing up. I'm wearing clothes from last year, some old shoes and no new haircut. I kept thinking I'd get laughed at. Instead, I'm greeted by a couple of friends who were in my English class last year. And it hits me, Mrs. Grewell, my crazy English teacher from last year, is the only person that made me think of hope.
talking with friends about last year's English and our trips, I began to feel better. I received my schedule, and the first teacher is Mrs. Gerwan, room 203. I walk into the room and feel as though all the problems in life are not so important anymore. I am home.
Two words that Narada wrote. Hope for a boy who was hopeless, and home for a kid who was homeless. When you're an English teacher, that's the best alliteration you can have. And I say that to you because Phoenix Academy provides just that. For kids who have been picked on, for kids who feel different, for kids who realize, I got something to say, it gives them hope. It allows them to take those baby steps, allows them to fall and to get up and to keep on going. But more importantly, just like my student, they needed a home, a place to try, a place to fail, a place to succeed. So 203 became just that. A place where 150 kids, most of whom were undiagnosed with those learning disabilities, began to peel back those layers, began to struggle, and became scrappy. And even though they had never read a book, they began to think, what if we write our own? A book that's not just written by dead white guys in tights, but a book written by somebody who has been in the trenches. A book written by someone that has something to say. So in order to do that, I realized my students had to read, and to read often. And we were going to read every great book written by every kid who also had something to say. We were going to read a book by a little girl in a tiny little attic. A little girl who would look out her window and watch her friends being let off like sheep to slaughter. And yet every day, this girl fearlessly, intentionally, and deliberately picked up her pen and told her story. We were going to read a book about a little boy who was crammed into a cattle car, rode into Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp, watched his entire family perish in a chimney. And he too was going to write that obituary. He too was going to make his parents immortal. He too was going to allow words to resonate never again. We were going to read a book about a little girl on the streets of Bosnia-Herzegovina, a little girl who had snipers shooting at her on her way to school. And my kids struggled and struggled, and they fell in love with those characters. And they didn't go and get Cliff Notes, and they didn't rent the movie. They read. So much so that they wanted to bring those stories to life. And they wrote letters and sent them to a tiny little secretary who saved a little girl in an attic for 2 years, a woman named Meep Gies, who was a secretary who decided to take on the Frank story, to sneak in paper and pens and library books into that attic. And my students thought, if we write her letters and there are these cries for help, like a message in a bottle, we could send those letters to her. And this 87-year-old woman is going to hop on a plane, fly across the globe, and talk to 150 gangsters. It'll be that simple. Well, we are all sitting in this room today, and we know it is not that simple. But my students wrote and wrote and wrote. And yes, there was typos. And yes, there was grammar mistakes. And yes, there were spelling errors. But when this tiny little woman began to read each and every one of my students' letters, I need to believe, that she saw something much greater than the words on a page, much greater than a comma or a spelling error. I believe that she saw something in my kids that she saw in Anne Frank, and that is potential, and that is promise, and that is hope. And so this tiny little woman got in a plane, flew across the globe, and talked to my students, to hear what they had to say, to honor what they had written, to celebrate where they were going to go. And I have to believe that this ordinary secretary who had experienced something extraordinary, like the legacy of Anne Frank, is exactly like each and every one of those teachers that walk into those classrooms at the Phoenix Academy. I believe they see something in those kids maybe they don't see in themselves. I believe that those teachers are their greatest cheerleaders, their counselors, their therapists, their generals, and their soldiers. Because each and every day, those teachers tirelessly work with those kids to get them to say the right word, to write the right word, to read the right word, to right a wrong. And when those kids, like that beautiful gentleman we saw, go off to your high schools, to your universities, they're ready. They're using those wings to fly. 150 kids walked into my classroom. They were supposed to drop out at the age of 14 and be statistics. And 150 kids stayed in that home in room 203 for 4 years like a cocoon. And on graduation day, every single one of those 150 kids walked across that graduation stage and got their high school diploma. And they said, we don't have to stop there. And they kept going. So year after year, I get to watch my kids who didn't even think graduation was an option. They've gotten their bachelor's degrees. They've gotten their master's degrees. And some of my babies are working on their PhDs. PhDs. And yes, they still struggle. And yes, they still have to figure out the right words sometimes. But they've made it. And that's what's happening right here in Omaha right now. Kids are finding their purpose. They're finding their wings, and they are soaring. And when they soar, they will come back like a homing pigeon. I stand before you as an ordinary teacher who so powerfully believes in the power of words. But not every kid can process words like I do. So I have had to learn that every kid is an individual. Every kid needs a caring adult and a teacher who believes in them. And it takes a village. It takes each and every one of you, because I have those kids. You have those kids that may not be able to afford to go to a school to get that specialized help. So let's help them. Let's help them. Let's help them sit in a classroom and to learn and to be giggly like Sage was up here, who doesn't want to put down that book because there's one more chapter to read. That's like the angels singing. One more chapter to read. So let's let her finish that chapter, finish that book, and then write her own. Allow her to see kids who look like her and talk like her and come from where she comes from and says, I too want to read that chapter. I too want to finish that book. That's why we're here today. We're here to make dreams actualized. We're here to give voices to the voiceless. And most importantly, we are here to celebrate hope. Thank you for allowing me to tell a story about a very special group of kids. And if they had Phoenix Academy, I might not have had them, because they probably would have gone on to honors classes. They probably would have gone on to fancy PhD programs right out the gate. But if I could learn from Phoenix Academy to be a better teacher, I will. I am. And I can't wait to take the tricks of the trade from these incredible educators who have passion. I can't wait to take that back to my classroom so I can help the kids that I serve. Thank you so much for believing in kids, for allowing Phoenix Academy to be a place of hope, and allowing it to be a home for 75 kids. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the annual Phoenix Academy Scholarship Luncheon. The featured speaker giving the keynote address was Aaron Gerwell, founder of the Freedom Writers Foundation and author of Teach With Your Heart. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, October 1st, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Lisa Winton, Marketing and Development Specialist with Vic Gutman and Associates, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.